The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. So I want to just do two quick things before we set out. One is I want to introduce you to our bus driver, Rhea.
Hello.
Who had challenges similar to mine this morning and made it here.
Okay, everybody, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Wonderful to see everybody here. Okay.
This is actually a new road. This is Minara Mishar Yafo. This just goes underneath the main intersection by the Jaffa Gate. So we just made a right. Imagine you're walking up from the Jaffa Gate, and you just made a right turn, okay? And you left the old city behind you. And we're now heading out towards Ramat Eshkol. To our right, listen up, you'll miss this. To our right is the old city, okay? You can see the same hilltops. To our left, look at this building on our left, okay? Do you see how it's got very small windows? Which is very strange because in a minute, you'll see that to our right, there's a magnificent view. The reason is because that was one of the buildings that they settled new immigrants in the 1950s and 60s. And this was the border. Where we're riding now, to our right was Jordan, and to our left was Western Jerusalem. This was the actual border. That's why there's such a wide, nice avenue here today. So they built small windows because Jordanian legionnaires used to snipe into the western part of the city. Okay, this neighborhood that we're heading up into is called Ramat Eshkol. This is a new neighborhood. Everything you're looking at did not exist. These were barren hills before 1967. If you remember the story I told some of you on the rooftop of Israelite about Ammunition Hill and the battle for Ammunition Hill that took place at a Jordanian police station and the narrow trenches that the front soldier had to throw himself down on the ground, that happened up here on the hill to our left, a little further in. And like I said, it's you can actually walk there from the old city. It's about a 25-30 minute walk, or you can grab a cab. It's definitely worth visiting. It's right in here, basically behind here. That's the UN position. Zaminara kilo. All right. Do you remember the Terra Sancta and the Mount Scopus tower that you can see from the roof of Israelite? Remember that? Yeah. Hebrew University, Haaretz HaFeim, Titus the General. So that's this hilltop. You see it? Now you get a picture. The old city is down to our right. Okay? And we're now heading eastwards. Now, it used to be that you used to have to go all the way around this mountain. Okay? Today, there's a new road that goes underneath these hills, which is what we're going to take. We are back in East Jerusalem now. We're in what used to be Jordan. Pretty much everything you're going to see until we get to Masada, where it turns back into Israel, and I'll show you a map a little later. This, by the way, up on the left is the Hyatt Hotel. It's one of the most beautiful hotels in Israel. It was a very brave thing that they built it in East Jerusalem.
Mount Scopus.
But they pay a price for it.
This is East Jerusalem?
Yes, this is Mount Scopus up on our left. You can see the tower just barely of Mount Scopus. This is Hebrew University. Hadassah Hospital is in here as well. You can see the Augusta Victoria Tower ahead of you.
This is Arab or Jewish?
This area in front of us is Arab. This valley is called Wadi Jos. Now all the old Jerusalemites, people who've been around the block, they know Wadi Jos from the days before the Intifada. Best place to get your car fixed, half the price, stuff like that. You know what? It depends. There's still Israelis who come here and get their car fixed. A lot of Israelis figure, I'd rather pay a little more to get my car fixed than risk having to get the rest of me fixed.
Yeah.
But that's a whole interesting discussion. It's very sad to have to say that when you think about it. Okay? The American consulate is actually down here to our right, not far from. This, by the way, is the way to get to the Mount of Olives, which is one of the oldest Jewish, the most continuously used Jewish cemetery in the last 2,000 years that we pointed out. But we're going to go underneath this mountain. Now look on your right. On your right you can see this side of East Jerusalem. Can you look on your right?
Oh wow.
And that is Wadi Jos. Look at the old city. You can see it very clearly.
Where?
dome. You can see the Dome of the Rock. Okay? And of course, I'm sure you can see Israelite. All right? You can see the desert, which is where we're headed in the distance.
I see Rabbi Aaron.
There you go. There you see him? And that's actually the backside of the southern excavations, the corner on your left of the old city. And look in the valley down to our right, the barren valley. That's how all of this used to look 150 years ago. There was nothing here.
What is southern excavations?
Ah, what is southern excavations? That's a discussion for
myself.
I want you to know that a day is made by the bus driver. Every once in a while you get bus drivers who know what they're doing, like they know to stop there for a second to show you the view, you don't have to tell them. So that tells me we're in for a good day.
Yay!
Look how quickly we just left the beautiful scenery of Jerusalem, the trees, the forests, and now we're in the desert. Right? This is Midbar Yehuda, we're going to come to the edge of the Judean desert. You can see the Arab villages of East Jerusalem. One of these villages, Abu Dis, is the place that Arafat thought to make the capital of Jerusalem, which it seems will not happen, at least not with Arafat. Well, this is all Israel, it's just a question of who you ask in terms of what that means. We are today going to head down to the lowest spot on earth. Okay, this is not some tour guide, you know, sort of sentence. If you look up in the Guinness Book of World Records, the lowest place on earth above land, I'm not talking about the mines in South Africa, not man-made, is the Dead Sea Valley, the Dead Sea Basin. And actually, as we drive down, you will see very interesting signs. You see this traffic jam on your left? This traffic jam is what I went through this morning the other way. This is you don't see it like this at this early hour. This is a direct result of yesterday's suicide bombing. They're taking security today very, very, very seriously. Yesterday, unfortunately, in Netanya, in a mall in Netanya, suicide bomber. It's an interesting political debate whether you call him a suicide bomber or a homicide bomber, because he's not committing suicide. Actually, they think it's a she. No, I'm sorry, it's a he. He's not committing suicide, he's committing homicide. But anyway, so a bomber walked in, blew himself up. Yesterday they announced that 3 people were killed. There was a little girl who was injured as well. There were 50 people who were injured, 5 of them very seriously. And one of them, a little girl, actually died in the middle of the night. So a set of parents woke up this morning to a whole new world. When you consider Cheryl Mandel's discussion with us yesterday, you realize it's a difficult day for some people. You look up to your straight ahead of you, you will see the city of Male Adumim. Now, technically, we're back in the West Bank. We're back in over the Green Line. We still don't see the banks of the river. You remember the discussion we had yesterday. This is the largest city over the Green Line. It's called Male Adumim. There are almost 30,000 people there. The second largest city is Beitar, which we saw yesterday. You look up, and we're heading now deep into the desert. No, Male Adumim is Israeli. The villages that we just passed are Israeli, are Arab. To our right was Izaria. Now, I'll tell you a couple of interesting things. I'm not going to talk too much, but I'll tell you a few things on our way down. Again, night. How do you say what? Time out? Time out. First of all, just as an aside, you will notice on the sides of the road very interesting phenomenon, and that is Bedouin. Okay? Now, by the way, you see that soldier up on the hill back of us? He is overseeing the Mahsam. Right? The roadblock. One of the lessons we learned the hard way was that you always need a a cover position. Somebody oversees.
In case killed.
Yeah, in case somebody opens up. It's as much psychological that Arabs see that and kind of think twice as it is strategic. Anyway, you will see on the road here interesting phenomenon. Bedouin Arabs.
They're camel.
Right. Like, you look up there, you'll see a couple of Arabs and a camel. So, the Bedouin, historically, they believe that the Bedouin came down as northern Arab tribes, probably from the area of Iraq and Syria, and maybe as far north as Turkey, 2,000 to 2,500 years ago. They are a nomadic people. And that means that traditionally, they didn't live in fixed dwellings. They were desert dwellers. They're scavengers. When Bedouins break camp and move on, you don't find anything that they left behind. They take everything with them. They're largely shepherds. Because they're shepherds, and that's a story we're going to talk about in a little while, you know, we don't really think about this, but a camel on today's market is worth approximately $3,000 new. Okay? So if you see a Bedouin, he's got 20 camels, he's a rich man. And goats can run anywhere from $300 to $900. So if you're a Bedouin, you don't have a lot of money, and one of your goats runs off into the desert, you're going to go find it. Because, you know, per capita and relative ratio, to us, that's like a $30,000 investment. So they teach their children very young how to track. And they learn how to track in the desert. And the Israeli army uses Bedouin and Druze as trackers. Druze we'll talk about tomorrow when we go to the Golan. Uses them as trackers. It's really incredible what they can see. In fact, maybe I'll tell you the story. Look up on your left. You'll see shepherds who've taken their sheep out. They're grazing. You look at this, it does not look like there's anything to graze on. That's because they eat every last blade of grass. You look on your right, you'll see there's a little more. You know, we're deep into the summer, so there's less grass. This is a Bedouin encampment, and you can see how they live. Unfortunately, a lot of the Bedouin today, just like a lot of the Jews, are kind of discovering the joys of living in the big city. Some of them even going to universities. And we're losing that way of life. There are less and less Bedouin that live this lifestyle.
Where are they?
They live generally along water routes. And there's actually a water pipeline, the National Mobile Pipeline. And they kind of tap into the pipeline and take the water. Most Bedouins support Israel. Most, not all. Even though they're Muslim or secular. Every Arab in this country is allowed to volunteer to serve in the army. The overwhelming majority of them do not. And of course, if an Arab does volunteer to serve in the army, he goes through a very rigid security clearance. It's interesting that in the entire country, the town that has the most per capita soldiers who've fallen in battle is actually not a Jewish town. It's a Druze town called Dayat al-Karmel. It's up near Haifa. Not far from the Golan, where we're going to be tomorrow. And that's because many of their sons volunteer for combat units. They're fierce fighters, and especially trackers. And the trackers in the Israeli army do very, very difficult duty. If you look on your left, you'll see this, the settlement of Mitzpeh Yericho, right? It's a little town. It's called Mitzpeh Yericho because it looks out over Jericho, which we'll see in a little while. You look on your right again. The Druze are actually a secret religion. That's a longer discussion, which we'll definitely have tomorrow. In terms of where we are now, by the way, look ahead at the mist of the Jordan Valley, right? And that has to do with the fact of the differential of temperatures, because it gets really, really hot down there. Hot air rises. Cool air is coming down. Cool air drops down. So cool air coming down this wadi from Jerusalem. You have hot air rising from the basin, and that's how you get that mist. Usually you get that in valleys that are right below mountain areas. Now here's an interesting question to you. Why is desert desert? Okay, you may think that I learn these things because I read and I study. I actually learn these things because this is one of the questions that one of my children once asked me, right? That's the kind of question your four-year-old asks you. Why is the desert the desert? It's a good question. So I'll tell you the major reason that desert is desert. The main reason is that the ground on which desert sits has no earth. It's pretty much all shale rock. Okay, you look around, you'll see it's all shale rock, hard rock. Now, in agricultural areas, when rain falls, okay, so it hits the ground and it gets absorbed in the earth, and that's how things grow. But in desert, it can't be absorbed because it's falling on rock. So what it does is that it slides, and it basically slides, water slides to the lowest possible point, follows gravity. So what you have is waters that fall, that begin to flow. Now, by the way, we're going to talk about this a little later. Imagine that it's raining in Jerusalem, and there's rainfall at the edge of Jerusalem, where we just came out of. And it's hitting desert, which is shale rock. It's going to naturally flow downhill. And since the valley floor goes downhill all the way to the Dead Sea, which is about 60 kilometers, right? Or, I don't know, it's like 40 miles. So imagine how much speed water picks up when it heads down this valley. And by the time it gets down to the area that we're going to, what was rainfall in Jerusalem has become a flash flood in the valley. That's why you get flash floods in the desert, right? And what's amazing is that on a day like this in the winter, it can get hot. You're in the Dead Sea. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Not a cloud in the sky. And you don't realize that up in Jerusalem, it's raining. So there's a water buildup that's coming your way. It takes about 1 to 2 hours, depending on the speed and the amount of rainfall. And, you know, basically a wall of water can be heading down your way. And if you're in a valley and you get caught in a flash flood like that, you're history. So there are actually flash flood warnings. Maybe later I'll tell you a story about that. The other reason, by the way, okay, here's Charlie the camel. We're just passing sea level, by the way. Now you're going to start to hear your ears pop. We just went below sea level, yeah. No, the way you can tell we went below sea level is when you look at the camel, its ears are up. No, I'm just kidding. There's a sign that says sea level. Anyway, Jerusalem is 600 meters above sea level. Now, I want you to imagine one thing while we drive, and then we'll give you a little air, okay? I'm going to give you a little background. Can you hear me? The story that we're going to see today, okay, is really the continuation of the stories that we saw, some of them in the Old City. There were a group of Jews, not that many of them, but there were a group of Jews in the year 68 and 69 of the Common Era that saw the writing on the wall. The Great Revolt broke out in the year 67. By the middle of 67, Jerusalem was under siege. And there were some Jews who realized there was just no way. The army was too mighty, the Jews were too corrupt, and so they started to try to escape. And small groups of them, see on your left, 150 meters below sea level. Okay? If you swam 150 meters below sea level without a submarine, you'd have a nasty day. A meter is about 3 feet. It's about a yard. Look ahead of you, you can see very clearly the Jordan Valley. Okay? Look off to your left, and you'll see two interesting things. One is you'll see a high, very specifically peaked mountain, and that mountain is called Sataba. All right, do you see that on the edge, on the right?
Yeah.
It's on your left now, all right? See that one mountain that seems to stick up a little? Sataba was one of the mountains that they actually burned the bonfires to let the Jewish people know about the new moon. Look up a little further back on your left, closer on the ridge, that antenna.
Yeah.
That is the site of a Roman forward position. The Romans had positions along these mountaintops that guarded the entrance to the empire. Okay? And that dates back about 1800 years. More interesting, if you look on your left, you will see the city of Jericho, Jericho. It's a little hazy, so it's not as clear. This is actually a tropical climate, funnily enough. This is the richest agriculture in the country. This valley, we're going to talk about this tomorrow, is part of the African Rift, the Great African Rift. And for various meteorological reasons, produces very rich earth. For example, 70% of Jordan's agriculture is in this valley. No, Jordan is directly ahead of us. We're still in Israel. Yeah, we decided not to take you to Jordan today. This is the Jordan Valley. Okay? To our right, we're going to head down to the Dead Sea Valley. To our left, we go up the Jordan Valley. We're going to come the same way, only we're going to go north, to our left, to the Golan, tomorrow. We're now 300 meters under sea level. It's almost 1,000 feet. And we're going to get 100 meters lower before we get to the Dead Sea. On your left, by the way, you can see a military bunker. And if you look on your left, by the way, you can see this kind of broken earth. This is the edge of what leads to the Jordan River. Okay? We're going to talk about that a little tomorrow. They're called the Ma'barot. They're called kind of, broken up land. And they form a natural obstacle to tanks, which is going to be important for our discussion tomorrow, because even though this looks like a wide open valley, since the main vehicle for modern warfare on the ground is tanks, wherever tanks can't pass is very significant. There are actually only three major crossing points where tanks can cross the Jordan River. And that has its advantages from a defensive position. It is tremendously challenging from an offensive position. And God forbid, for example, when the Iraq war broke out, Israel made a decision, especially once the Scuds started falling, this is back in 1990, that if the Iraqi army crossed the Jordanian border heading towards Israel, Israel would not fight the Iraqi army on Israeli territory. We don't have the luxury of being able to afford losing a war. And Israel made a decision, and made it a very public decision, that if we ended up fighting Iraq, we would go into Jordan and fight them on Jordanian territory. Needless to say, this produced a flurry of political activity to prevent that happening, which is, of course, why Israel announced it. Now, if you look up ahead of us, half left, you'll see a very clear structure. And I'll explain this in a few minutes on the map when we get out of the bus. But this was actually a Jordanian hotel, and it was actually used for Jordanian officers. It was an army base, and you can see the lower structures, part of the army base. This is a very important juncture, given that it controls the entrance both to the Jordan Valley and the Dead Sea Valley, north and south. And there were some fierce battles that took place here. This fell to the Jordanian Legion in 1948, and we took it back in 1967. And you can actually see the odd bullet hole in the wall. It kind of demonstrates sort of what we're talking about. Now look on your left, and you will see very clearly the Dead Sea. Okay, the Dead Sea is Kishmo Kenu, just like its name, dead. And what that means is that there are no fish in the Dead Sea. Right, it's a little salty. We're going to talk about this later when you go swimming there. You will discover if you go swimming in the Dead Sea anywhere on your body that you have a cut. Believe me.
Yeah, I just cut my toe.
They say it actually helps it to heal.
Okay.
It does cause some significant discomfort, otherwise known as pain. The most important rule for the Dead Sea swimming, by the way, this is the continuation of that army base. These are Jordanian barracks. And you can see some of the bullet holes from the battles. Later, they were actually used by the Israeli army as training grounds. So not all the bullet holes are from war. Now you can really see clearly across the valley of the Jordan. Today we have a peace agreement with Jordan, which of all the peace agreements we have, I think probably is the most promising. Well, that's my opinion, and I could be wrong. Look on your right. These are date trees. These are palm trees that produce dates. In fact, this is the beginning of the season. They're starting to harvest them. You can see on your right. What's amazing about this is that the kibbutzim in the area that decided to start to produce agriculture here went back to their history books to see what worked 2,000 years ago. And they discovered that the main crop that people lived off down here in the time of the temple were palm trees. So, logically, they figured that would work. It took a while, and they figured out how to do it, and they planted palm trees. Most of the dates that come from down here are delicious. Maybe you'll get a chance to buy some later. One of the things about a palm tree is that palm trees take a very long time to grow and produce fruit. There's a famous story, some of you remember, when we were walking around the old city of Rabbi Hanina, who was planting a palm tree, and he was 80 years old. And one of his students asked him, why are you planting a palm tree? You're never going to see its fruits. And he said, I won't see its fruits, and my children won't see its fruits, but my grandchildren will. So the palm tree represents the fact that you do things in this world not just for yourself, but because you believe that there's a future. You can make a case for saying the state of Israel exists because of the Jewish belief in palm trees. But we won't get too theological. Really, they planted them to make money. Now, we're going to take a brief stop in about 2 minutes so that I can show you a view before it gets too hot and tell you a fascinating story. Okay, seems like it's cool. We just left Jerusalem. We're in the air-conditioned bus. You are going to feel the difference in the climate in a minute. All right? This is my gradual progression. By the way, look on your left and you'll see the border fence. This is not the actual border. Look how there's a road that seems to be like, it looks like somebody swept it. Okay? That's the border patrol road, which is very different from the actual border. The actual border runs through the Dead Sea, halfway across the Dead Sea. But Israel needs an area where they can patrol to see that no one has snuck across the border. Twice a day, a special Israeli army vehicle dragging something sweeps that path clean, and patrols ride up and down that that area, and Bedouin trackers from the Israeli army make sure that there are no fresh tracks and that no terrorists have snuck in. We are going to take a stop. I will explain to you where we are when we get off. I am about to tell you an incredible story. All right, come on off. Watch your step here, lots of rocks. You're wondering about the temperature, I have a knack for that. Huh? You're over 80 degrees now. Right, in Jerusalem now it's about 70.
Wow.
And in Jerusalem it's cool. There, right, you can feel the difference, right? And notice what I just did. You have to wear a hat here. Okay, you don't realize 15 minutes in this will bake your skull. Okay, so when we get off the bus, make sure you have a hat. Alright, let me first give you an idea of where we are. Okay, just to give you an overview. Okay, this is the map of Israel. This is north. This is south. This is actually correct. North is this way. South is that way. Okay? Right? This is Jerusalem. Over here. And this is Ephrat, Gush Etzion. You can imagine Jerusalem's a little bigger and Ephrat is a little smaller, but you get the point, right? I actually drew this quite a few years ago, not realizing that the fact that it's orange would be significant, but okay. So yesterday we went here. Alright? Today, we went this way. Down to the Dead Sea. And here, and we're basically right here, right now, okay? So we went east, Jordan, north to the Kinneret, right? The Jordan River feeds the Dead Sea, okay? And right about up here, we're going to be tomorrow, you'll see the border between Jordan and Syria. And up there is Lebanon. Okay? Got it?
Yeah.
Now the story that I'm going to tell you really begins in Yerushalayim. But there were remnants of Jews who left Jerusalem before the Romans completed their destruction and headed east to the Dead Sea Basin. They were basically trying to get away from the Roman legions. Okay? And tell a little more of their story on the bus and the air conditioning, but you got to imagine what it must have been like. I mean, imagine that you're in the city of Jerusalem or around the city of Jerusalem and you escape the Roman armies. Or you manage to get out. And you want to get away. Now maybe you want to get away because, you know, it's 30 years before the destruction, but the Romans were notorious for their taxes. You want to beat the system, right? You're like the Unabomber, except you're not a Unabomber. You're out in the woods somewhere in a log cabin. Leave me alone from federal taxes. I don't want anybody to know I exist. So where do you come? You come down here. Because this is the Dead Sea. Who in their right minds, 2,000 years ago, would live here? Okay? That sentence will make a lot more sense to you in a few hours. Right? Imagine also that the road that we just took down in air conditioning in a bus wasn't quite the same, you know, in the year 68, 69. Imagine that you're with your family, your children. You're not walking during the day, not only because of the heat. The temple was destroyed in August, so we're talking about the heat of the summer. But also because if you're caught by a Roman legionnaire patrol as a Jewish refugee, your meat. So they hit out during the days, and they tried to move at night. Many of them got caught, captured, killed, tortured. According to Josephus, you could see bodies hung sometimes on crosses along the road as a symbol to somebody you can't escape Rome. But some of them actually made it down here, and they built a city. Some of them eventually took over the fortress that we call Masada, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes when we're on the bus. Some of them came down here and they built a city. Now there's some mystery as to what the city was and who they were, but I'll tell you how we found the city and then we'll get back on the bus, okay? There was a Bedouin, lived in the desert, not far from here, just like the guys we just saw. And one day he notices a couple of his goats have disappeared, right? They count their goats every morning, every night. So he takes a couple of his kids who are trained as trackers, and he sends them to find these goats. Now, you and I could not do this, right? You look at this ground. There are hundreds of footprints, thousands of footprints on this ground, okay? And if you're a good tracker, for months, until the rains come and wash them away, you can see the footprints there. Okay? I worked with a tracker, a Bedouin tracker, and what he could see in the earth was unbelievable. I mean, he could tell you which direction a footprint was headed in when it was walking. He could tell you how much weight a person was carrying. He could tell, I mean, whatever, I'll spare you for now. Anyway, so these two kids start tracking these goats. And they track them eastwards to these cliffs. And then they realize that they've gone down the sides of cliffs. Now later you may be lucky enough to see the ibex. I'm not sure you will, but maybe.
The what?
Ibex are mountain goats. And when you see mountain goats, the way you hear them when in the Engedi Reserve is by the sound of little rocks. Because they jump across the cliffs and they displace a few rocks. You look at a cliff like that and you imagine this, right? You're like hanging there like one of the newspaper advertisements. Goats, they just run across. They leap. And their feet are perfectly positioned to catch like little clefts. It's incredible to watch, okay? And so these kids start climbing down to try to find the goats. And they come to that cave. You see that cave over there? Okay, they come to that cave. They slide into the cave thinking maybe the goats took refuge from the sun. They don't find the goats, but what they do find is a cave full of earthenware jugs. Amazing. Earthenware jugs. And they don't know what they are, so they break one of them open, thinking maybe they found something. And they're very annoyed because all they found was like old papers. But they take one of the old papers because they figure, you know, maybe they can sell it to some tourist or somebody. And they head back, they find their goats, they go back home. And then a couple of days later, they sell this piece of papyrus, this piece of scroll, to a Christian tourist, French Christian tourist, for $1, which to them is an enormous amount of money. This was the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This Christian tourist shares this with a friend, asks him if it's worth anything. The friend gets very excited, gives it to another friend. Eventually it ends up in the hands of a fellow by the name of Father DeVoe, who is a Catholic priest who is also an archaeologist, who is blown away. Because when they carbon date this thing, it's 2,000 years old, and it's a description, a piece of the book of Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel. And when he compares it to our book of Ezekiel, he realizes word for word it's exactly what we have today. So he eventually gets an expedition going. Now this was Jordanian territory. The Jordanians had no respectable department of archaeology. They had no use for archaeology. They're a different mindset, right? It's in the 50s. So they basically sold the rights to the Dead Sea Scrolls to this expedition, which basically was the French Catholic Church. So now the French Catholic Church has taken control of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are part of Jewish history in Jordanian territory. Okay? And they excavate these scrolls, right? And there are over 2,000 scrolls that are eventually excavated from this site, from this cave, and two other caves. Now, the most amazing thing, and we'll talk about this on the bus in a minute, is that the overwhelming majority until a couple of years ago of these scrolls were not released. They've been working on this for 50 years. 10 of the scrolls succeeded in being sort of smuggled out, or taken by the Israelis. In 1967, remember, after the Six-Day War, we took over this whole area. Now, all the scrolls had already been excavated. What we did do was we figured that if there's scrolls up there, there must be a city. So we excavated the site and found a city called Qumran. This is the city of the Essenes, the Essenes. Big debate who they were, what they were. It's accepted that they were Jews. They're mikvahs here. They were a very, very, very spiritual group. They apparently must have done a lot of mikvahing, right, immersing, because they have a lot of mikvahs. Mystery as to why they came down here. Most people believe they came down here to escape the oversight of the Roman Empire. It was originally thought that they were ascetic and that they were celibate. Now we know that's not true. We have scrolls that describe priestly activities, all sorts of other things. And again, on the bus in a few minutes, I'll talk to you about that. Because the church controlled the overwhelming majority of these scrolls were not released until somebody smuggled one out as a microfiche, and they created a big scandal. There was a book, I forget what it was called. I think it was called The Dead Sea Scrolls. It was a fascinating book as to theorizing as to why the church withheld, okay, the release of these scrolls. And I'll give you just one piece of food for thought. The earliest scrolls are dated to 100 before the Common Era. The last of them are dated to about 80 after the Common Era. Right? Now, what major event in Christianity happened between 100 BCE and 80 CE? Right. So these should shed a lot of light on what was going on in the country, and specifically Yeshkeber, right, Jesus, down here in this area where he was purported to have been. Okay? And my personal theory is the fact that you find no mention of him in these scrolls is somewhat troubling for the church. Okay? Anyway, this is going to be important, this story, when we get to Masada. So I want to do one last point, and then I'll take any questions, and we'll get back on the bus, because I don't want you to debate quite yet. Turn around. Turn around. This, to me, just says it all. Look at this field. Okay? If you came down here 30 years ago, and you said, let's plant, okay, cotton, bananas, melons. Okay, those are actually melons down there. And, you know, they'd say you were nuts. Nuts. The Crusaders didn't even come down here. They couldn't imagine there was any point to being down here. There is a verse in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. It says that one day when the Jewish people will not follow the ways of God, blah, 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 all these things will come to pass. They'll be exiled from the land. And it says, V'haita ha'aretz shomema. And the land will become desolate. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, who was a 13th century Kabbalist, who actually ended up in Israel, says, while this is a curse, it is also a blessing. Because alongside the fact that God tells us that the land will become desolate, he also promises us that as long as the Jewish people are in exile, this land will never yield its fruits. The Crusaders came here, they built the kingdom for 100 years, they tried desperately to create an agricultural success, couldn't make it work. The Arabs, for 300 years, which is when most of the Arabs started to come, and really 150 years ago when Jews started to come, never really succeeded in turning this land into an agricultural paradise. The book of Isaiah, Yeshayahu, says one day that they will come when the Jewish people begin to come home. Vayasem midbarak Eden. And they will turn, I will turn the desert into the Garden of Eden. Okay? What you're looking at is the fulfillment of a 2,700-year-old prophecy. And especially tomorrow we go north, you'll see this all along the desert floor. Yesterday we saw this. Barren hills that have been brought to life. You know?
So they must have put in a whole irrigation system here.
They actually invented an irrigation system to be able to do this. Because the normal irrigation would flow off the Dead Sea, but you can't plant things from Dead Sea water.
So how?
And they had to plant things before they had modern computerized irrigation systems. So they had a whole system of how to use brackish water and how to feed it into here. Israel also invented the concept of hydroponics. In Gush Katif, for example, which is the most successful agricultural experiment in Israel, all of their farms sit on top of sand. Now, until Israel was born, no one ever farmed in sand. How do you farm in sand? They created a system called hydroponics, things that are planted in water, okay, in sand, and the sand holds the water. And that's how things grow. Unbelievable what they grow. By the way, which solves all sorts of halachic problems for Jews. For example, during the sabbatical year that you can't eat certain things that come from the ground. But if it's hydroponics and it's sitting in the air, it's not in the ground, etc. Jewish knack for finding loopholes. Okay, I don't want you to bake. So let's get back on the bus. If anybody has any questions, feel free.
Didn't we find a pair of tefillin with the Dead Sea Scrolls?
They found tefillin. They found all sorts of artifacts, some of which you're actually going to see at Masada, not the tefillin.
Okay.
Those are in the Israel Museum.
Not the right.
And the tefillin that they found are exactly the same as the tefillin we have today, from 2,000 years ago. Black, unbelievable. In fact, they're preserved very well because of the climate here. Yeah. What? No, not at all. Most of the Dead Sea Scrolls are sitting in the Rockefeller Museum, which is in East Jerusalem opposite the Damascus Gate. Israel had a debate what to do about that after 67 and decided not to create an international, you know,
Tehran.
There are many, many Jewish archaeological historical artifacts that do not belong to the people who are holding them. That doesn't stop.
The Museum is a Jewish museum?
No, the Rockefeller is not a Jewish museum.
What is
it? It's actually a Catholic museum. And in fact, if you're Jewish, and I know this from personal experience, unless you get special dispensation, you're not allowed in there.
What museum?
Mm-hmm. They won't tell you that. I wanted to see the Dead Sea Scrolls. I walked into East Jerusalem, went to the Rockefeller Museum, had a kippah on my head. They told me it was closed. I said, when is it open? I'm sorry, it's only by special reservation and appointment. Later I met a guy who actually ran groups for a Baptist church, and he regularly goes in there. So I did a little research and found out that they don't want Jews seeing these scrolls because they didn't, this was back then, I don't know, maybe it's changed now.
How long ago was this?
About 8 or 9 years ago, when I was first working in Israel. Because they didn't want Jews creating the controversy around the Dead Sea Scrolls.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.